up that cultivated son-of-a-bitch smile. But he'd been alone then, and he was still alone with it. There was no way to imagine what Garrett had said or thought 2 decades ago, staring at those wet rails that had mercifully sealed the blood flow. He'd been alone and conscious for more than an hour by the time my sister Shelley found him. "Old wounds," he said now. "Fuck that." Then the bats came out for real. Cameras stopped flashing. People's mouths dropped. We all just stared at the endless cloud of smoke drifting east into the hill country. Smoke looking for a few jillion pounds of insects to eat. Garrett smiled like a kid at the matinee. "Unfucking real," he said. In 10 minutes, more bats passed over our heads than the total number of people in South Texas. Somewhere in that time, Maya had taken my hand and I hadn't pulled it away. The tourists unfroze. Then, one by one, growing bored with the bats, they drifted off to the parking lot. Maya and I stayed perfectly still. Finally, Garrett wheeled his chair around and pushed himself up the hill. Maya stood and followed him, then I followed her. It was hard to miss Garrett's VW safari van. In the dark, the mound of plastic pineapples and bananas that was hot glued to the roof made the van look like it had hair. When we got closer, I saw that the paint job was just the way it had been years ago. Rows of Miss Mirandas along the sides, all in outrageous Caribbean dresses.
"They don't dance like Carmen no more?" Maya suggested.
Garrett grinned at her as he slipped his chair into the lift grooves. "Will you marry me?" A few minutes later, we were sitting on bean bags and drinking Pecan Street Ale from Garrett's cooler. My eyes teared over from the smell of mota and very old patchouli. Garrett had booted up his portable computer, several hundred pounds of wires and hardware that had years ago taken over the van's back seat and whose generator required most of the luggage compartment. Then he stuck in our mystery CD. Garrett frowned. He thought about it for a minute. He tried a few commands. He cracked open some files and looked inside. "Slice and dice," he pronounced. "Easy to fix, if you got the other disc." Maya looked at me, then at Garrett.
"The other disc?"
"Yeah. You split your data between 2 discs. The program to reassemble, it's pretty simple. But you read 1 disc alone, it's all nonsense codes, man. Scrambled eggs. Pretty safe way to store sensitive stuff." I took a drink of my Pecan Street and thought about that. "So you can't tell anything about what's on there?" Garrett shrugged. "It's big. That much data usually means detailed graphics." "As in photographs?" Garrett nodded. Maya stared at the dingo balls around Garrett's windows.
"Garrett," she said, "if I was using photos to blackmail somebody..."
He grinned. "You just keep looking better, honey."
"If I was, why a CD? Why not just keep the negatives?"
Garrett took a long drag on his joint. His eyes glittered. You could tell he was enjoying figuring out the devious possibilities. "Okay. You can't encrypt negatives. You can't lock them so that nobody but you can make copies. Somebody finds them, then they'll know exactly what they're looking at, right? If it was me, shit, yes. I'd scan everything in. Keep that as my master print, then shred the negatives. You got your 2 discs, you got your program to reassemble. In a couple of minutes, you can print up as many hard copies as you need, or, even better, upload those suckers onto the net, and pretty soon they're printing out at every news desk and police station in the state, if that's what you want. But if somebody comes looking through your stuff, unless they're very good or they know exactly what they're looking for, they don't find shit." Garrett stopped and took another hit. "So who's got the other disc?" I took out a flyer that had been folded in my pocket for a long time. I looked at the date. July 31st, tonight, 9 to midnight. Driving like bats out of hell, we could be there just when things started cooking. No offense to the bats. Besides, Garrett was leering at Maya's legs again and about to offer her another beer. If I didn't make a counteroffer, we'd be here all night. You like art openings? I asked her.
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook. So please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.
This is Audible.
Lone Star Audio presents an unabridged recording of Big Red Tequila by Rick Reardon.
Chapter 34. Even with the windows rolled down at 10 at night, the Buick felt like the inside of a blow dryer. I sat shotgun and watched the subdivisions go by while a cold triangle of sweat glued my shirt to the back of my seat. The smell of dead skunks and brush fires blew through the car. I guess I was being too quiet. When we passed Live Oak, Maya finally reached out and touched my arm.
You still thinking about Garrett?
I shook my head. In fact, I hadn't thought about much else since we'd left Austin. I'd been foolish to think I'd get away from Garrett without one of his lectures. While Maya retrieved the rental car from the Marriott parking lot, Garrett had given me his philosophy on old girlfriends. Then, for the millionth time, he'd catalogued Dad's offenses against the family. How Dad had basically abandoned Garrett and Shelley after their mother had died. Left them with his abusive second wife for years while he went out drinking, politicking, falling in love with whores and junior leaguers. How Garrett took to running away and Shelley took to abusive men.
By the time he married your mom, it was too fucking late to make any difference, Garrett said. Shelley and I were out of the house and your mom was too damn nice to change him. She never told you the last straw, did she? You were in, what, 10th grade? The bastard took your mom to some party at the McNay Museum, then disappeared. When your mom and her friends finally found him, he was down in the woods by the old fish pond screwing the lights out of Junior Leaguer number 7. He just smiled, zipped his pants, and went back into the party to get another drink.
Garrett laughed weakly. Then he looked down at where his lap should have been.
Let the bastard stay dead, little brother. It's the only thing that's ever given me a sense of justice.
Maya exited in downtown San Antonio. We drove past the decaying mansions of the King William District, then across East Arsenal where the San Antonio River flowed by, sluggish and polluted with tourist leftovers. Its banks, this far south, were empty except for the crack addicts. When we pulled up in front of Blue Star, the gravel lot was already full to bursting with BMWs and Ferraris. Women in evening dresses did coke on the hoods of their cars. Men in black sweated in the heat and drank champagne on the old loading docks of the renovated warehouses. An apathetic handwritten sign in front of one of the larger galleries announced Bo's opening upstairs at a loft space called Galleria Azul, perched at the top of a narrow iron fire escape. Inside the gallery, half-hearted Western swing warbled from a few wall speakers. Somebody had put an old saddle on the table next to the sign-in book. 20 or 30 people were drifting around the room, looking at bad photos of authentic cowboys. One of the guests was wearing a starburst Jerry Garcia tie, clipped with a wrinkled green press pass that had been old during Watergate. He came up next to me from behind the beer keg and quietly belched garlic.
"The beer's free," Carlin McGaffrey said, "but these little sandwich things suck."
In one hand, Carlin had a spiral notebook pinched between two fingers and a stack of canapes in his palm. He handed me his cup of Lone Star from the other hand so he could shake with Maya.
"Carlin McGaffrey," he said, "you're not Lillian."
Maya smiled.
"Likewise, I'm sure."
Carlin nodded. He was nice enough to puff his cheeks out for the next belch, holding it in.
"You hear about your buddy chef?" he asked me. "Somebody made his office into a drive-through morgue last night."
"I heard." Carlin waited. I looked disinterested. Finally, Carlin's blue eyes detached from my face and made a circuit of the people in the room, looking for new prey. Okay, he said. I've seen ranches, I've seen cows, I've seen Councilman Asante schmoozing it up and back. So far, I see nothing worth a headline. I looked around the corner into the back room of the gallery. Sure enough, against the side wall, his beer set casually on top of a metal sculpture, Fernando Asante was holding court. He had on an after-hours outfit. Black jeans, white silk shirt over his huge belly, a denim jacket with the Virgin Mary embroidered in sequins on the back and on the breast panels. Two plump ladies in satin dresses stood on either side of him. A few businessmen laughed at his jokes. The curly-haired Anglo bodyguard I'd seen at Mi Tierra lounged nearby. He was the only one who didn't look enchanted to be in Asante's presence. What the hell? I gave Carlin back his beer. Keep your eyes peeled, Lois Lane, I told him. I have to go say hello to somebody. I looked at Maya to see if she was coming. Maya looked at Fernando Asante, who was laughing at his own joke and patting the rump of the nearest satin cherub. Then she looked at Carlin, trying to eat canapes out of his palm. She let me steer her toward the back room. Asante gave me his best gold-toothed smile as we came up. He gave Maya a head-to-toe appraisal and seemed to find her a good risk. When he nodded at his fan club, they excused themselves in unison, all except for the bodyguard. Jack, Asante said. Good to see you again, boy. He loosened the silver Texas-shaped bola around his neck. He offered me a well-manicured hand to shake. I declined. Councilman, I said. Hell of an outfit. That jacket weep on holy days? He just smiled and shook his head, then leered at Maya. I like patronizing the arts, ma'am. I always do admire beautiful things. Maya smiled warmly.
You must be Mr. Asante.
Asante looked gratified. His face just oozed charming elder statesman. That's right, princess, he said. And you are...
Endlessly amused by the tabloid stories Trace reads me, she cooed. Is it true, the one about you and your secretary in the same pair of underpants?
Asante's pupils dilated down to pinpoints. His genitals probably followed suit. Somehow, he managed to keep his smile intact. I can see Mr. Navarre has been around you a little too long, princess, he said. Maya leaned close, as if to tell him a naughty secret.
Actually, I taught him everything he knows, and if you call me princess again, I'm going to throw up on your Virgin Mary.
Speaking of nausea, I said, I didn't know you were a fan of Beau's work, Mr. Asante. Do you know him? He wasn't quite sure who to look at now. He regarded Maya like a dog might look at a snake, trying to determine how dangerous this little thing was. The bodyguard had moved a little closer, just enough to share the gallon or two of Aramis on his chest. My eyes began to tear. Asante looked from Maya to me. Why, Jack? You looking for an autograph? Just curious, I said. I wanted Beau's professional opinion on some photos I've come across. I waited for a reaction, but I might have been talking about the Rangers' chances in the finals. A man in a yellow silk shirt and black genie pants came up to us, apologized, and peeled a red sticker off a sheet of labels. He pointed to a photo behind the councilman. This one, Mr. Asante? The photo was about 8x11, with Beau's name scrawled at the bottom. It showed an abandoned ranch house on a hill overlooking the Texas plains. In the nighttime sky behind the house was a bloated full moon and a single meteor streak. In the foreground, rusty iron gates rose up. The name, Lazy B, was arced across the top in black metal cursive. One gate was open and unhinged. Asante looked back at it lazily.
Sure, son, that's fine.
The gallery employee marked the picture sold, apologized again, and left.
Lazy B, I said.
That stand for bastard, maybe? Asante ignored me.
Good bargain, I'm told it's one of Carnau's best. One of his older shots, he said to Maya. I always buy something, long as it's small and priced to sell.
He leered at her like that was a private joke. Then he looked back at me. And how's the job market for you, son? Haven't given up yet. Actually, I said, I was wondering if your friends at Chef Construction could find me some work. Asante stared. Pardon. I figure there'll be a lot of money in this new Northside Arts Complex you're planning. Biggest pork barrel since Travis Center. Bigger, maybe. I also figure it's a sure thing Chef will get the contract. That's your arrangement with him, isn't it? Asante looked at his bodyguard, nodding that he was ready to move on. The Aramis man came and stood next to me. Misinformation is a dangerous thing, Jack, Asante said it almost blandly. The city grants contracts by anonymous bidding. When we approve a bond package for a new project, we only then look for the right firm. Goes through the numerous committees and the chamber. I really have very little to do with it. Does that clear things up for you? Shucks, I said. No kickbacks or anything? Asante couldn't have smiled colder. You know, if I were you, Jack, he said, leaning forward to deliver some private advice, I'd take this young lady back to California. I'd go back where the prospects are better. The life expectancy is longer. He showed me his gold teeth. Up close, his breath smelled like used motor oil. I'll file that in the proper place, I promised. Asante took his beer from the top of the statue, nodded politely to Maya. Good night, Jack. He walked away with his bodyguard in tow. Maya raised her eyebrows. She looked like she was about to exhale for the first time in 10 minutes when Carlin came up, hands still full, and nudged me with his elbow. Okay, back window now. I stared at him. He kept walking toward the back of the room, not waiting to see if we would follow. When we caught up, he was standing on the tips of his huaraches, peering down through a tiny metal-barred window into the alley behind the warehouse. Okay, he said. Dan's blonde, right? Drives a silver Beamer? Yeah. Carlin frowned. You want to tell me why he's delivering a sack lunch to Bo Carnow in the alley? Maya and I looked out. It took a few seconds for our eyes to adjust to the darkness outside before we saw the two figures. One blonde, sitting with his arms folded on the hood of the silver BMW. The other, a balding brunette, visible because of his stark white tux shirt. Sure enough, Bo was holding a brown lunch bag, shaking it in Dan Shep's face like he was unhappy with it. Maybe Dan forgot to pack a dessert, I said. Dan just sat there, silent, in the shadows. I couldn't see his face, but his body looked stiff, tense with anger. Then, while Bo was mid-sentence yelling at him, Dan delivered the same haymaker swing he tried on me in Lillian's front yard last Sunday. This time he connected. Bo went over backwards and the lunch bag spilled thick green bricks of cash across the alley into the light from the gallery windows. Or maybe he didn't, said Carlin. Chapter 35. After Dan Chef's taillights disappeared down east to Arsenal and Bo started staggering back through the alley, Carlin paid the gallery owner with the yellow shirt and the genie pants $50 for the use of his office. It was probably the most money the gallery owner had seen all night. We waited less than 5 minutes before Bo came in to clean up. His tux shirt was stained and half untucked from his Jordaches. His left hand was cupped over the eye Dan Chef had just punched, and he was cursing somebody's great-grandmother. I stepped in next to him and slapped his good eye with my open hand. I probably could have just punched him, but I was in a bad mood. The palm strike in Tai Chi is arguably the most painful attack. It's a soft strike, the way a whip is soft. Sometimes it takes a layer of skin off. I didn't want any more standoffs with Mr. Carnow. Bo's cursing cut off in a startled grunt. Now blind, he stopped walking, but I kicked his legs out from under him and kept him going forward, directing his fall into a director's chair. The chair groaned, but didn't break. Shit, said Carlin. I took the brown paper bag off the floor where Bo had dropped it and spilled the contents on the desk in front of Carlin. The green bricks were stacks of 50s.
For a second, I thought Carlin would have a coronary. Bo stayed very still, both eyes covered, head down. He sounded like he was struggling to remember the tune of a song. When he finally looked up out of two swollen eyes, he had to stare at me for 2 minutes before he realized who I was. Blood washed through his face. He thought about getting mad, then seemed to realize he didn't have the energy for it. "Great," he mumbled. "Wonderful." I touched his right eye. He winced. "Dan decided to charge some interest this time," I observed. "What's the problem, Bo? Eddie couldn't be your delivery boy this time?" "Trace," Maya began. I ignored her. With a pair of rapidly swelling eyes, it was hard for Bo to look mean, but he was trying his best. I took the ceramic steering wheel from the broken road trip statuette out of my pocket and tossed it in Bo's lap. "I didn't plan on it, but it seems I've started collecting your stuff." Carnow's face was paralyzed for a moment, then there was a glimmer of recognition. "What the hell?" "Bo," I said, "let me give you some perspective here. I have one disc, you have the other. Without both of them, I'm betting you don't have shit to keep the people you've been blackmailing from eating you alive. You want to talk about that?"
"I don't!"
he started to yell. Then he just stopped and stared at me. He brought his fingers to his temples and started making little circles with them. Maya said,
"Mr. Carnow, it would be best if you talked to us."
He focused on her, dazed. Then his face hardened.
"You sound like a fucking lawyer," he said finally.
Maya tried a smile.
"I'm not representing anyone."
That made Bo laugh, a shrill little sound.
"Wonderful," he said. "That's all I need."
He picked up the ceramic steering wheel and threw it back at me.
"I don't have shit to say to you, and I don't have a clue what you're talking about."
I looked at Maya. "I'm not representing anyone," I repeated. "Great line. Opened him right up." Maya shrugged. Carlin was sitting behind the owner's desk, chewing slowly on a canapé. He was using one of Bo's unmatted prints for a beer coaster. His blue eyes reminded me of a buzzard's, the way they look on while the bobcats are finishing up a carcass, hungry, patient, highly interested.
"So where's your dad's murder come in?" he wondered.
Bo's forehead turned maroon.
"Who the fuck is this?"
"We've got a lawyer," I told him, "and we've got an entertainment writer from the Express News, ready to go for your jugular.
What I suggest, Bo, is you just answer yes or no when I ask you something. You tell me you don't know what I'm talking about one more time, I'll make sure Carlin here spells your name right in the Sunday edition. Got it?"
Bo decided to stand up. I planted another red handprint on the side of his face. He sat back down in slow motion, his head bent down into his hands.
"I'll kill you," he mumbled, without any conviction at all.
"The photos on the disc," I said. "They show the same thing as the cut-up prints in your portfolio, a night meeting in the woods, three people, something that happened between them bad enough to warrant $10,000 a month in blackmail."
I think he nodded. It was so slight I could hardly tell. I picked up some of the money on the desk.
"The 731 payment was due today, but there's a lot more here than 10 grand, and Dan must know you've lost one of the discs. I'd say you made a deal to sell him the other. You close your accounts and run. He gets insurance that the photos are out of circulation. Only you stalled him tonight. Maybe that's why he hit you."
"Fuck off."
I'll take that as a yes. "Where the hell is Lillian, Bo?"
Bo was shaking slightly, his head in his hands. It took me a minute to realize he was laughing. When he looked up, his eyes had turned into puffy slits.
"You're a fucking joke," he said. "Still playing her goddamn protector."
My throat tightened. "You want to explain that?"
"She's real good at that, getting people to protect her. I tried it for years. Chef tried it. If you're lucky, maybe she's dead and buried, Navarre. Maybe that's where she is."
Maya had a hell of a grip. It was only her grip on my elbow joint that kept me from disassembling Karnow's face. She held me in place until my forearm started losing circulation. Then she leaned close to my ear. "Come on," she murmured. "Enough." We left Beau collapsed in his director's chair, still shaking like he couldn't control his body. I took the bag of money. We walked past the frowning owner in the yellow shirt and the genie pants, down the metal stairs and into the parking lot of Blue Star, where the black-dressed men were opening another bottle of champagne. It wasn't until Maya took my hand that I realized how hard it was clenched. We walked Carlin to his car, a new turquoise Hyundai parked in the loading zone with a fake police light on top. He took a silver flask off the front seat, drank half, then passed it to me.
"Remind me to put you back on my Christmas list, Navarre. I don't ever want you pissed at me."
I sampled the stuff and grimaced. I stared at him.
"Jesus. Big Red and tequila?"
He shrugged.
"Breakfast of champions, Navarre. You gave me the recipe."
"You ever thought about growing up, Carlin?" he snorted.
"Highly overrated, man. I wait for the video."
I offered Maya the flask. She shook her head.
"Now tell me the story."
Carlin stopped, just short of rubbing his hands together in anticipation.
"I've got a gallery review to write."
"No story," I told him. Carlin looked dazed, as if he were translating the two words. Then he laughed.
"Right."
I stared at him.
"Wait a minute," he said. "You bring me out here so I can see a high-profile businessman making a payoff to the guy who's blackmailing him for, what, 10 large a month? You bring up Lillian, you bring up—"
He paused, then smiled very slowly as he made the final connection.
"Shit. You said Eddie. That corpse the mob drove into Chef's office wall. Eddie something. And you tell me no story?"
He laughed. I didn't. 24 hours, I said.
"What the fuck for?"
"Lillian's in this somehow, Carlin. Publishing anything might kill her." He thought about that for a bit. "What else do I get?" I was tired and irritated. I stepped a little closer to him, then picked up his Jerry Garcia tie with two fingers and admired it. "My name back on your Christmas list," I reminded him. Carlin hesitated. He was breathing so shallow now, I couldn't even smell the garlic. His pale blue eyes looked at me, steady, calculating. "We could have been doing a business deal." Finally, he shrugged.
"Like I said before, I'm just trying to help."
I nodded, swallowed the taste of Big Red tequila out of my mouth, and threw the flask back into Carlin's car. I knew that, Carlin. I knew that.
Chapter 36. It was midnight when Maya and I left Blue Star. Seeing as how neither of us had eaten in 6 hours and most of the town was closed down, I had to swallow my pride along with 3 chorizo and egg taquitos at Taco Cabana. At least I didn't compromise myself enough to try the neon pink chain locations. I drove Maya to the original Cocina on San Pedro and Hildebrand, still a sleepy wooden shack that gave no indication of the million-dollar franchise it had spawned.
"Why is it orange?" Maya asked the cook behind the counter. She had stayed with her habitual favorite, Huevos Rancheros. The plate was overflowing with eggs and pico de gallo, beans, handmade tortillas, and grease. The cook frowned, not understanding the question. I tried to explain the virtues of Tex-Mex over Cal-Mex to Maya. I was feeling contentedly native again when I turned to the confused cook and said in Spanish, "She doesn't understand why it looks different. I told her it's more cheese, more lard in the beans." I tried to get fancy with the vocabulary. The cook yawned.
"Man," he said, "either you're from California or you're a fucking Cuban. Nobody says habichuelas for frijoles."
Shamed into silence, I made a mental note of the vocabulary problem and retreated quickly with my pile of tacos.
"What did he say?" asked Maya.
He said you'll be quiet and eat it if you know what's good for you. We sat under the ceiling fans on the patio and watched the occasional VIA bus grind down an otherwise deserted street. A vagrant stopped for a minute to admire our midnight breakfast. He was dressed in a ragged brown cowboy bob outfit, complete with bandolera and toy pistol, his eyes unfocused and milky. I handed him my last taco. He grinned like a 5-year-old and ambled on. I was thinking about Lillian, trying to remember how she'd acted and what she'd said the day before she disappeared. But when I called up her face, it was blurred with images of her at 16 or 19. It scared me how fast she was dissolving into an old memory again. However much I kidded myself about knowing her, I couldn't even guess about her last few years. I couldn't discount the idea that she might be involved in what had happened, maybe deeply involved. She had asked for court protection against Karnow last year, only to go back into business with him. She'd broken off her relationship with Dan Scheff last spring, then reestablished contact with me a few days later. She had brought me back to town, told me she loved me, given me something people were dying over, then vanished. I wadded up my taco tinfoil and made a basket in the trash barrel. I tried to focus on translating the mariachi music on the kitchen radio. Maya had evidently been looking at me for a while, following the same train of thoughts. Her expression was soft and resigned. "We need to know," she said. "You need to see her through somebody else's eyes, Trace." She took my hand. I stared out at San Pedro, then gave Maya directions to Lillian's house on Acacia Street. The conjunto and beer were still flowing at the Rodriguez's when we drove past. The windows were lit up orange again. The yelling and the breaking glass inside told us that a spirited family discussion was underway. Maya parked the Buick around the corner. Then we walked up the alley and slipped into Lillian's backyard. No police tape on the back door, no sign that the police had ever been here. In 2 minutes, we worked open a lock in the guest bedroom window and stepped inside. Maya's 10-pound keychain came in handy once again. Along with a Swiss Army knife, a mini canister of capsaicin, and keys to most of the Western world, she kept a pencil flashlight in her purse for just such an occasion as a friendly B&E. In the thin beam of its light, Lillian's living room looked about the same as I had left it a week ago, trashed, but not alarmingly so, at least not alarming to me. "Yuck," whispered Maya. "Is this normal?" "Yes," I said, then reluctantly, "maybe, I don't know." A screen door screeched open at the Rodriguez place, and a puppy yelped as it was shooed outside. Some woman cursed in Spanish. "You feed the damn thing!" Men laughed. The bass was turned up. "I don't think you need to whisper," I told Maya. "We could take clogging lessons in here, and the Rodriguez's would never notice." We checked Lillian's computer first. There was a half-finished spreadsheet for the gallery on file, a few word-processed business letters, a few standard software applications. The only disks on her desk were blank. She had no CD-ROM drive, much less the capacity for creating such a disk. The only thing we learned was that the Echo Amano gallery wasn't even making enough money to bother recording. In the corner of the main room was a board and cinder block bookshelf that dated back to our college days. Maya and I pulled out books on everything from O'Keefe to Christo. Unread textbooks with forgotten pressed flowers inside. 5 or 6 years worth of Sunset and Texas Monthly, all smelling like mildew and Halston. Finally, Maya opened a white photo album and shone her flashlight on the first page. In the little yellow halo of light, Lillian and I stared up at us. I was wearing a tuxedo. She wore a red silk kimono over her black pantsuit, holding a peacock feather. The outfit, of course, had been a gift from my mother, an act of revenge as Lillian and I were preparing to go to my father's 60th birthday party back in my first year in college. I'd like to say that I remembered the rest of the details about that night. The truth is, I didn't. I looked at my own confident, very young smile, the way Lillian looked up at me with her head slightly tilted toward my shoulder. I couldn't imagine myself ever having been there.
Maya flipped the page quickly. Pictures of Lillian's family, several of us, all old and faded, a few of Lillian's paintings. Maya closed the book.
There's nothing here, she whispered.
She got up and moved on. When I followed Maya into the bedroom, she was shining her flashlight on Lillian's white wicker baby carriage. It was lined with red gingham and filled with rows of antique porcelain dolls. Ever since junior high, that carriage had been in Lillian's bedroom, wherever she lived. I remember feeling nervous the first time I'd kissed her on her bed, looking over her shoulder at all those little porcelain eyes.
It's my mother's, Lillian had laughed, biting my ear. Family heirloom trace, I can't get rid of it.
I touched the gingham blanket. There was a small bundle tucked underneath. I brought it out. 10 letters, postmarked from San Francisco, each carefully refolded and placed back in its envelope. Before I could put them away, Maya took the stack, noticed the address, then dropped them lightly back into the doll collection.
So that's what happened to all my stamps, she said.
She shone the flashlight right in my eyes as she turned away. I tried to believe it was an accident. After a few minutes in the bathroom, Maya found a cigar box full of assorted junk. Door handles, rubber bands, costume jewelry, and a rather large diamond engagement ring. Maya held up the ring and examined it. Finally, she said,
Can I assume you didn't mail this too?
I stared at it, wondering how many years I would have to work for something like that, assuming I ever got a job. Maya's expression was tightly controlled, but from the cold fierceness in her eyes, I guessed she was pondering where on my face she might most effectively embed the engagement ring. It was a strange feeling, sitting on Lillian's bathroom floor, having a stare down with my former lover by the light of her pencil flashlight. Then the police siren sounded. It was a few blocks away and probably had nothing to do with us, but it reminded us where we were. 10 minutes later, we were back in Maya's Buick, heading out of Monte Vista. I said nothing except to direct Maya through town until we were crossing the Olmos Dam. Then I said, Wait, pull over. Maya frowned. She looked at the narrow road that sloped off 100 feet into the basin on either side.
Pull over where?
Just pull over. I got out and leaned against the hood of the Buick, which was only slightly warmer than the air. Tonight there was no storm coming through. It was clear and orange with light pollution, with the only visible stars right at the top of the sky. I wasn't sure why I wanted to be here again, without even the defense of a tequila bottle, but I wasn't ready to go home either, wherever the hell that was. Maya got out of the car, uncertain at first what to do. She sat down next to me, followed my gaze.
I used to look at the stars out in the countryside after my father went away.
Went away. She still called it. I tried hard to imagine her as a 6-year-old child crying as her father was dragged away by the Red Guard for re-education. I tried to picture her as a teenager before she'd been re-educated herself by her English-speaking uncle, then taken to America, leaving the rest of the family to suffer the consequences. But it was the opposite problem I had with Lillian, who I always saw in the past. With Maya, I couldn't imagine her any other way than she was now. Sensual, adult, as carefully polished as teak wood.
In my home village outside Shaoxing, she continued, smiling sadly, there was this huge old plum tree I used to sit in. I'd look up at all those millions of stars and envy them.
Yeah, I agreed.
She shook her head. No, I envied them because they were so few. I used to dream about being in such a small population, being alone and silent like that, with a few glorious centimeters between you and the next person. You don't understand what a billion means unless you're Chinese, Trace, and you don't appreciate zero.
I wanted to argue. I stared at Maya's face, watching her force herself not to cry. I thought about death and absence and memories as foggy and sore as a tequila hangover. Even stone sober, I couldn't figure out why I'd come home, but I thought I appreciated Zero pretty damn well. Before Maya could stand up and walk away, maybe for good, I put my hand on the back of her neck, very gently, and pulled her forward. The dam was nearly deserted, but I think two cars went by before I opened my eyes again. The second one passed with a horn blaring, someone yelling insults at us that faded into the dark with the taillights. Maya's eyelids were still wet on my cheek. She didn't say anything, but guided my hand under her blouse, up her back. Her skin was cool. My fingers traced her spine all the way to her shoulder blades, then undid her bra with a single twist. Her laugh was shaky, the end of a silent crying spell. "You must have been a terror in high school," she said into my ear. "I'm a terror now," I said, but it was muffled. I held her underneath her blouse and slid down into the smell of amber and the taste of salty skin, thanking God and Detroit for the wide, smooth hood of the Buick. Chapter 37. Around 1:30 in the morning, the only light in San Antonio was from street lamps, stars, and my landlord's TV. Looking upstairs at the one blue eye in number 90's paralyzed face, I wondered what was on television at this time of morning that was so interesting. Or maybe since Gary was half asleep all the time, he didn't need to be all asleep any of the time. I think Abraham Lincoln said that. I'm not sure whether I felt worse or better with Maya leaning up against me, her arms around my waist as we walked to the front porch. I simply didn't care at the moment about anything except lying down on my futon and going comatose. That was before I realized that my futon was already occupied. I should have known when Robert Johnson failed to scold me at the door. I think Maya sensed it first. She froze with her hand halfway to the light switch, even before I heard the snick of the revolver cock. "Everything on the floor in front of you," he said. The flashlight beam that hit our faces was from no pencil-thin model. I squinted, blind, and raised my hands. Maya dropped her purse. Her keychain hit the floor like a small bowling ball. "Okay." His voice was slightly familiar now. "Kneel." We did. "You going to knight us, buddy?" I said. "It's usually done with a sword." The air moved. Maybe I could have dodged the kick if I hadn't been so tired and so blind. As it was, I just had time to turn my newly corrected teeth to keep them from getting rebroken before our guest's foot stamped Doc Martin on the side of my face. I managed to get back on my knees without crying out. My cheekbone didn't feel broken, but everything was fuzzy now. The left side of my face was going to look like a rotten tomato in the morning. "That's track one," he said. Then he turned on the lights. The redhead was holding the Colt 45 in his left hand because his right arm, the one I'd broken outside of Hung Fong's last week, was in a cast. He looked like he hadn't shaved or slept or even bathed since that encounter. The lit fuses in his eyes told me that this was a man who'd already pulled the pin and had decided this was as good a place as any to stand until he blew up.
"Tell us what you want," said Maya.
She spoke the way she would to a distraught client, and I waited for it to backfire the way it had with Bo. This time, though, it seemed to work. Red lowered the gun slightly. He kept his eyes on me.
"You know," he said. "And don't even fucking tell me it's not here. You don't want to know what Strack 2 is."
I found myself wondering if his eye sockets could really be that dark blue. His face looked so old and leprous now, I started to doubt he was the same man who'd attacked me last Tuesday. I showed him that I was going for my shirt pocket, then with two fingers extracted the disc Garrett had given me. It had scrambled photo data on it, all right. Pictures of Garrett's last fishing trip with the New Mexico branch of the Hell's Angels. I threw it at Red's feet. "Rough week?" I asked.
"Trace, shut up," Maya hissed.
Now, Red had a problem. With only one hand, he couldn't pick up the disc and hold the revolver at the same time. He pointed the gun at Maya.
"Get up."
He made Maya pick up the disc and come toward him, keeping the Colt 45 aimed at her chest where he couldn't possibly miss.
I didn't think Maya would try anything, and even if she did, I wasn't sure I'd be in much shape to help. But I paid close attention to her body anyway, looking for any sign she was tensing up. It didn't happen. She slipped the CD into Red's jacket pocket, then knelt down again. Red seemed to relax to a temperature just under a rolling boil.
Okay. You want your tea leaves red now, Navarre?
More than once a month is bad karma, I said. His laugh was more like a brief facial spasm.
Nobody's going to break any arms tonight. Nobody's going to write any fucking messages on my shirt or put their fucking elbow in my face.
Okay, I said. I looked at Maya out of the corner of my eye. We came to an understanding. We were both looking for a sign that Red was ready to kill. As long as he kept talking, we were all right. But more than 4 seconds of silence meant he would fire. If that happened, we went for him. And one of us died for sure, but maybe not both of us.
You ever been hit by a black talon? He said.
Once, almost, Maya said.
Nasty little fuckers,
he continued, looking at me as if I'd said it. Red tried to scratch his face, then remembered he was holding a gun. I think it was only then that I realized he was drunk as well as desperate, so his reflexes would be a little slower. At 3 feet, with black talons from a .45, I wasn't exactly relieved. He said,
"Once they open up, they don't leave much of your chest cavity, man. Makes a ragged son of a bitch hole. One guy I saw got it from the police. He just screamed until his lungs came out of his throat."
I nodded. "Not as quick as bullets through the eyes, then?" That registered in his face like a cattle prod. He aimed the Colt at my head.
"So we're gonna put things right," he said, as if he were just ending a pep speech to the team. "We're gonna give this back. I'm gonna get my ass out of this town, and you maybe get to live."
None of us bought that, not even Red. He shrugged.
"If this isn't the disc, it's going to be a lot more fun, man. A lot more fun for your lady here."
I stared at him, trying to look cooperative and unimpressed at the same time. The way my face was contorting on the bashed inside, I probably looked more like Bill the Cat. "You and Eddie worked for Chef," I said. "That's who we're going to?" The idea amused Red so much he decided to kick me again, this time in the gut. When I got my face out of the carpet a few centuries later, I saw 1.5 redheads with guns hovering in front of me, smiling.
"Now, unless you've got more questions, let's go."
We left in Maya's car. Whatever Gary Hales was watching on television, it must have been more interesting than your run-of-the-mill abduction at gunpoint. He never even looked out the window. I played chauffeur while Red sat in back, his .45 aimed lazily at Maya's head. We turned off Eisenhower onto the stretch of Austin Highway where the strip malls that hadn't been abandoned yet housed head shops, heavily barred pawn and liquor stores, beauty salons that still had faded pictures of beehive models in the windows. Every few seconds, I glanced back at Red in the rearview mirror and watched his eyelids drooping. Once, when his chin dipped an inch, I almost made a move. Before I'd taken my hand off the wheel, the Colt barrel was in my ear. "Don't," he said, no sleep in his voice at all. I smiled in the mirror, then concentrated on the road. It must have been 2 a.m. The drunks were starting to stumble out of taverns like the Stars and Bars, or the Come On In to find their cars to sleep in, preparing to wait out the unendurable 6 hours until the bars would open again. Bikers clustered in the parking lots, invisible except for the glint of Harley steel and the orange tips of their joints.
"Next left," Red said.
We passed a row of mobile home parks and pulled into one where the plywood sign on the cyclone fence out front said, "Happy Haven." The gravel and strips of corrugated steel and broken patio furniture that littered the courtyard said something else entirely.
There were 5 other cars in the lot, all in various stages of disassembly. The courtyard was lit only by a yellow car repair lamp draped over the branch of a dead elm tree. I handed the Buick keys to Red, and he and Maya got out first. We walked to the 3rd trailer, a dented white and green metal canister that looked like an oversized hat box. Red opened the screen door, then waved me inside. This time, I knew something was wrong the instant the air hit my face. It was cold as a meat locker inside, and it smelled just about as bad. Refrigerated animal waste overpowered the other smells of bourbon and cigarettes. It was also pure black, except for the yellow square of light from the door we'd opened. Somewhere off to the right, a window unit air conditioner hacked and wheezed to keep the room under 60 degrees. I tried not to gag. Then I went inside and began talking, as if there were really someone there. "Long time no see," I said to the blackness. Maya followed my lead, then rolled away to the left. I went right and nearly tripped over something soft and wet. As I slid down against the cheap wood paneling on the wall, I could feel a few dozen splinters shooting up into my arm. I made myself not move. Red was only 2 steps behind us, but he was in the light now, and we weren't. It only took 2 or 3 seconds for him to realize something was very wrong and decided to blow holes in the dark with his Colt. In that time, both Maya's feet hit his kneecap at a 90-degree angle. The cartilage snapped like celery. Red shot a 2-foot-wide hole in the trailer roof as he staggered forward. Before he could shoot again with better aim, I got his good forearm in play Biwa posture. It's called that because when you twist the 2 bones of the forearm across each other and keep twisting, they snap with a sound resembling a plucked string on a Chinese lute. At least that's what Sifu Chen had told me. It sounded more like a percussion instrument to me. Red screamed and dropped the gun, but he didn't go down until I double-chopped his neck just below the jawline. Then he melted into the shag carpet and started snoring. Maya was already crouching down in the corner with Red's 45. She closed the front door of the trailer with her foot. After a few minutes, staying absolutely still, listening to the air conditioner whine, I groped up the wall until I found the light switch. The first thing I noticed when the light came on was the color of my hand, then the thing I was sitting on. I thought it was a waterbed mattress the way it gave under me, but waterbeds aren't covered in blue silk, and they don't have white hair. I got up, turned it over, then made a face as contorted as the corpse's. Terry Garza was 4 hours early for our appointment. Blood had flowed out of his neck so freely it had finally blossomed and crusted over into a huge, grotesque rose on his neck. The anticucho skewer that had brought it into bloom still sprouted from the center. I tried to remind my stomach that it belonged inside my rib cage, not my mouth. It didn't listen very well. "Look someplace else," I told myself. I stared at the flower-patterned sofa Garza had rolled off of, the striped mattress in the far corner, the 3 empty beer cans rattling on top of the air conditioner. There was nothing else in the trailer. Maya unfroze more quickly than I did. Without speaking, she retrieved her keys and purse from Red, then killed the overhead light. With her flashlight and a handkerchief, she started going over Garza's body, checking pockets, looking at his hands and feet. Garza's face had a twisted, almost puzzled expression. His eyes stared out the ragged skylight Red had blown in the roof. At the moment, Garza looked like he had even more questions than I did. "Don't hold your breath," I told him. Garza held his breath. If anybody in Happy Haven had heard the shot or cared about it, we hadn't had any indication of it so far. Nevertheless, my internal timer was telling me it was past time to leave. I used Red's flashlight to make a quick check of the kitchen while Maya examined the dead man. Under the silverware tray in the left kitchen drawer was a 6-month lease to Terry Garza of Chef Construction.
When I got back to Maya, she was looking at a photograph she'd found on the dead man. She frowned when I interrupted her train of thought by showing her the lease. "Che Garza." She looked at me, nodded as if I'd said something of absolutely no consequence, then looked back down at the photo. "Hello," I said.
"I apologize," she said at last. "Maybe you should tell me more about your father's murder."
She handed me the photo. It was almost identical to the one I'd seen in Carnal's portfolio, but in this one, the blonde man's face was turned toward the camera. I still didn't recognize him. The two missing figures were slightly closer to him. On the back, 6/21 was written in black pen. "Last month's bill from Mr. Carnal," I said. Maya started complaining in Mandarin about my ignorance.
"Facial hair fooling you again. Look at the bone structure of the cheeks, the eyes."
I looked more closely at the face of the blonde man. It was thin, with deep-set eyes, crooked nose, clean-shaven, and short, slicked-back hair. I imagined him with longer hair, curly, and a darker beard. Suddenly I realized what the blackmail had been about. The revelation wasn't exactly uplifting.
"Randall Halcom," I said.
"With his killers,"
Maya agreed. Chapter 38. I got no sleep the rest of the night. At sunrise, I was lying on my futon, memorizing the ceiling and getting cold from Maya's breath condensing on my skin. Finally, I extracted myself from underneath her arm and got up. Robert Johnson looked amazed that, for once, I was the first one out of bed. He immediately began playing tackle football with my feet as I tried to walk toward the kitchen. I would have cursed at him, except I knew he'd curse back loud enough to wake Maya. I stumbled here and there, righting the coffee table, picking up clothes, putting the fallen paperbacks back on the kitchen counter. I struggled into some underwear and stood in front of the bathroom mirror for a while, picking wood paneling out of my arm, then reapplying mercurochrome to my busted cheek.
"What a looker," I told myself.
Robert Johnson stared at me from the lid of the toilet and yawned. I slipped into shorts and a sweatshirt and did a solid 2 hours of Tai Chi on the back porch, starting with a low stance to shock my muscles into working. After a while, the thighs and calves unknotted, and I got too sweaty even for the mosquitoes. I was just starting to feel better when the neighborhood woke up for Sunday. The two pairs of eyes reappeared in the upstairs window across the alley and stared at me through the mini-blind slats. The lady next door came out to read her paper on the patio again. This time, I hardly warranted a second look. She kept her coffee cup firmly in hand and tightened her terry cloth robe. Then she smiled wickedly as she let a small herd of chihuahuas out the back door. For the last half of my set, they threatened me from their side of the fence, yapping insanely and popping up into the air like a tireless row of Mexican jumping beans. Meanwhile, their mother read aloud to them from Roddy Stinson, repeating the funny bits. I tried to be grateful for the challenge to my concentration.
"Think emptiness, Navarre. Blue water trickling down through your body. Cultivate the G."
This morning all I cultivated was a headache and the need to pee like a racehorse,